So we're in the middle of a series called Wisdom, and this is actually our sixth week. We're going to spend the entire summer in the books of Wisdom, and it's a great time in the summer to for us who normally preach to just take some time off, and it's a great time to just get people from our community who are probably way better communicators and tell funnier jokes than I ever could. Clearly, another joke that failed. Oh my gosh, I'm just going to stop. But anyway, we're excited that Jeff Hanen is going to be joining us tonight. And Jeff is the executive director of the Denver Institute for Faith and Work. And the Denver Institute for Faith and Work, or DIFW, if you will, is an amazing organization that Jeff founded, I don't know how long ago, actually. But it's a movement in the city where we're trying to, and Jeff and other churches around the community, around the city, are trying to marry the idea of work and faith and integrate those, because oftentimes we see that there's a divide, a division in those things. And so Jeff is doing amazing work, and he's kind of in the forefront. And honestly, the city of Denver is kind of in the forefront of the nation in regards to marrying these two things. And so Jeff has quite the bio. I just kind of looked it up, and he writes, contributes to magazines Christianity Today, Review of Faith and International Affairs, Leadership Journal, and Comment Magazine. He was a missionary in Latin America. He was also a pastor and school administrator there. He has a BA from Valparaiso University in International Economics and Spanish, a Master of Divinity from Denver Seminary, and he and his wife and three daughters are members of Colorado Community Church here in, or just in Aurora. And so, yeah, he has three daughters under the age of five. So with that, will you help me welcome Jeff up, and he'll be speaking today.
Good, man. You know, Denver Institute's a young organization. And as you get something started, you're never quite sure how it's going to be received. And New Denver is one of those places where not only received with open arms, but I don't know if Stephen is here. Stephen Redden has been such a good friend. Just immediately he said, let's try to get this going. He introduced me to his networks. And that's one of the fun things about the Denver church culture. People are really open-handed. So we're going to be talking about work today. That's stuff that we do every single week, generally from Monday to Friday, or for Coloradoans, Monday to Friday at about 3, and then we go up into the mountains, right? But we're going to be talking about work, and we're going to have some slides as well, but we're going to be in the book of Ecclesiastes, because as you take a look at the wisdom literature, there's one author of a book in the wisdom literature that talks more about work than anybody else, and his name is Kohelet. Kohelet is a Hebrew word that's oftentimes translated as either the preacher or teacher, or just the questioner, and we're going to talk about that. But first, let me give you a little bit of background to myself. So 2 years after I graduated from graduate school, I was living in a small apartment with my wife near the tech center. We had one little kid at that time, little Sierra. She was about 12 months old. My wife was pregnant with number two, and of course, we were scraping together three part-time jobs, right? I had two part-time jobs. She had one part-time job. I once got a call then one day from one of my part-time job employers, said, actually, we don't need you anymore. And I thought, what is going on here? So I took a walk one night out, and I prayed, and I kind of let God have it, kind of in the way that you see the Psalms. I said, God, what is going on here? I got the grades. Where is the dream job? Where is a job that can at least support my family? And I started to get more and more frustrated. I started to actually also do some research. Am I the only person in this context? Am I the only person feeling this way right now? And so I wanted to look, okay, what's going on in our culture right now? So I did a little bit of research about millennials and work. And I found three things. One, college debt. I don't know if you've ever had any of this, but it turns out there's a whole bunch of that in the United States right now. There's about $1.2 trillion of college debt out there. Got about 7 million college students right now are in default. The unemployment rate, also for 18 to 31-year-olds, 7.7% in 2007 and jumped to 13.3% in just 5 years. So two things, right? Got debt, unemployment rate is high, but also underemployment, which is you're just not doing exactly what you had hoped. That was definitely me. But you take a look at this, and one of the interesting things about millennials is millennials are still really optimistic that they're going to get their dream job, and it's just right around the corner. But 42% of millennials say that finding a career that you're passionate about is the top priority. You want to find a career that you're really excited about, right? And I could identify with that. You want to find a career you're excited about that has a big social impact. There's a guy named David Kinnaman. He runs this organization called the Barna Group, and he did a whole bunch of research on millennials, and he says, broadly, young adults want to make their own hours, come to work in their jeans and flip-flops, and save the world while they're at it. And I thought, okay, well, I love the optimism, right? And that's, I mean, I'm an optimistic person. I want to see awesome things happen. But I also wanted to take a look broadly. Is this like reality? Is this what most people understand work in the United States? So Gallup is an organization that does a whole bunch of polls and asks people about things. And one of the things they asked people about was their work. Like, do you even enjoy it? So they did a really, really big poll. And of the 100 million full-time workers in the United States, 70 million, or about 70% of them, are either not engaged or actively disengaged. So not engaged means basically you're just checked out, you're punching in, you're punching out, simply bored at work. You don't like what you're doing. Now, actively disengaged is actually a little bit funny. These people aren't just unhappy at work. They're busy acting out their unhappiness. They're actually working against their company's mission and trying to frustrate their company because they're so disgruntled. That's 70% in America. Globally, it's actually quite a bit worse. 87% are either not engaged or actively disengaged. So I take a look at my youthful optimism, but I also take a look at the world, and I think, okay, is this disengagement, is this kind of a retracting from work, is this right around the corner for me, or do I have better things in store? There's one guy named Wendell Berry, he's an author. He's an old guy now, written a lot of interesting books. He said, having hope is hard, and it's harder as you get older. Is that just an old pessimistic guy? I'm a young guy, right? That's what I think about. Is this just an old pessimistic guy kind of sees things, the bottom side of things? And I don't think so, because the first time I read the book of Ecclesiastes, I thought, this guy's just negative about everything, kind of what's his deal? But the second time I read it, I thought, now what is it about this guy that makes him skeptical about some things? This life under the sun that we're going to talk about, this life almost apart from God, and other things he makes him more hopeful for. So we're going to talk about that. And the questions that I had really for the sages, they're simple questions I think that a lot of us have at a lot of different points in our life. What job should I choose? What's my calling, right? Should I do high pay or high impact or neither? More likely what I was going to get. And so what we're going to do this evening is we're going to talk about a passage in Ecclesiastes, and we're going to kind of break it up into three parts. He talks about it, work in three parts. Number one is work is achievement. Number two, work is gift. And number three, work as service. So we're going to go and read the text. I think we might have a slide here for you. I'm going to read Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verses 9 through 13. And we're going to try to figure out what this guy has to say about work. What do workers gain from their toil? I have seen the burden God has laid on the human race. He has made everything beautiful in its time. He's also set eternity in the human heart. Yet no one can fathom what God has done from beginning to end. I know that there's nothing better for people than to be happy and to do good while they live, that each of them may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all their toil. This is the gift of God. Let's go right at the beginning there. That toil, right? Ecclesiastes 3:9. What do workers gain from all their toil? I think all of us have an experience, a time when work is not exactly satisfying, but it seems difficult, painful, seems more like toil than this creative, satisfying work perhaps that we were intended to have. Why do we get to this place of feeling like work is toil? I think it gives us, basically, in the book of Ecclesiastes, it gives us really three reasons why. And it's when we see work with three different ends. One is accumulation, one is ambition, and one is self-actualization. And we'll get to that in a second. But accumulation, so a little bit before Ecclesiastes 3:9, he goes to Ecclesiastes 2, and he talks about what makes him really ticked off and frustrated about his work. Ecclesiastes 2:17, he says this. So I hated life, because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me, all of it. A chasing after the wind. Well, first of all, he hated life because he didn't like his work. If you don't like your work, oftentimes you're not going to like life. But why didn't he like his work, right? What was the focus? What was the end goal of it? And he says, well, I hated it. I hated work. I hated all the things that I had toiled for under the sun because all those things I accumulated, I had to leave them to one who comes after me. And who knows whether that person will be wise or foolish for they have control, and they will have, yet they will have control over all of the fruit of my toil. That is, work becomes toil and frustration when it's focused on accumulation, when you're primarily seeing it on a way to accumulate and to get more and to kind of almost hoard it. So let me give you an example. This guy's name is Jeremy. He was a young investment banker, a young analyst on Wall Street, got a great job out of college, worked for Goldman Sachs. About 6 months, into his job, he fell into this deep depression, deep sadness. I mean, he was a really bright, you know, young college student, graduated from Columbia. He got a job trading commodities, which is things like corn and precious metals and all that other stuff on an open market. But he was lured, not because he actually wanted to do the work, but he was lured by this awesome starting salary, $70,000 a year, plus a bonus is up to $50,000. I mean, that's not bad for your first year out of work. But of course, he wanted a career in either urban design or politics, but he said, well, let's just do this, right? Let's just do this for a while. He had augmented his course a little bit for accumulation, and he found an industry that had lost its way in many ways. A guy named Kevin Roos wrote a book called Young Money, and he wrote the story of these eight young investment bankers, and Jeremy was this guy, and he says, what is your work like in this industry? And he found some actually pretty sad stuff. So one of the things that these young investment bankers do is they create these things called pitch books. A pitch book is a big stack of financial data that you're going to give to one company that's thinking about buying another company. Now, these things are not the most exciting thing to produce in the world, but they would often do them at all hours of the night. But the frustrating thing for these young analysts is you produce this, and oftentimes the company wouldn't even look at it. They kind of just glaze over it, and then it would be just tossed aside. Now, I spent all night doing that. What is going on here, right? The labor itself was boring, repetitive. He didn't actually enjoy it. And he also found that he felt commodified himself. He was trading commodities, but he felt commoditized himself because they were measuring literally the worth of employees with dollars. In Jeremy's little quarter of the trading world, all that matters was a person's P&L, profit and loss, and a related number called gross credits, which measured revenue generated by a single employee. So if you make a certain amount of money, you have value. If you don't make this much money, you have less and less value. One of the things that was the most difficult for a young investment analyst is this loss of freedom. So the investment banker's 9 to 5 is coming into work at 9 a.m. and staying the next morning until 5 a.m. to get all of your work done. This is actually not uncommon for young investment analysts on Wall Street to be living this way, and they totally lost freedom, lost broke relationships, lost boyfriends, girlfriends, gained weight, you know, lost some of their sanity. But the purpose of this is he got into it for the wrong reason. There's good reasons to get into investment banking, but his was for accumulation. And this is what Kohelet, the preacher, the teacher, this is what he says. He says, you know, I was king in Jerusalem. I had so much money, but I saw that all of this I was gathering together, ultimately, one day I'm going to leave it to another person. And I think oftentimes with our work, we kind of make this deal, right? I give you a certain amount of hours, you give me dollars. I give you hours, you give me dollars. That only works for a while, and I've had a whole bunch of part-time jobs. I've been a caddy, and I taught kids how to play soccer, and I don't even know the rules of soccer. And I understand that to a point. But if that is how you understand your work, you're going to find that you've accumulated these things. You gave people the hours of your life. You have these things, but if you take the long view, they are quickly gone. They're quickly out of your hands. Accumulation. There's a good place for money in work, but it can't be the first place. And this is the first thing he says. The second thing is ambition. This is Ecclesiastes 4:4, and I don't know if we have a slide in this, but if we don't, this is what he says. And I saw that all toil and achievement spring from one person's envy of another. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. First thing, when I hear this, I think, it's not a problem with me. I'm the typical Coloradoan. I think we live in a state where we're very unimpressed by people's status. We're very highly independent folks and say, hey, that's great for you. Congratulations, you got a promotion. But at the same time, things can kind of creep in on the side. There's this Denver Business Journal does this 40 under 40. You know, I don't know if you've seen this every year, right? 40 people under 40 years old that are really making it. And I read that and think, oh, 40's not that far away. I'm never going to be there. Actually, a well-known Christian publication did something very similar. 33 under 33, 33 people under 33 years old that have done amazing things to change the church. And I look at that and I think, oh gosh, I haven't done anything, you know? Not even good at, you know, standing up and speaking to people. And I think that can creep in oftentimes to a heart, this kind of comparison. The second thing, work becomes toil when it becomes inherently comparative and competitive. And I think this oftentimes comes in the side for us. But really, I mean, if I had a better job, if I had the title, would I be more satisfied? I think Kohelet would say, maybe. I mean, maybe. Because we all have heard stories of people, they've got there, and there isn't all that they thought it would be. Let me give you an example. A guy named Leo Tolstoy, he was a well-known author, wrote a book called War and Peace, which I have not read. It's very long. Read a couple of other of his books, and he got through kind of a midpoint of his career. He was really, really, really well-known, really famous, and he actually hit a really deep part of just a dark part in his life, depression. And at that time, he wrote a book called Confessions. Augustine had wrote his own Confessions, so he wrote a book that's called Confessions. This is what he says. 5 years ago, something strange began to happen to me. This is Tolstoy speaking. At first, I began having moments of bewilderment. My life would come to a halt as if I did not know how to live or what to do. I would lose my presence of mind and fall into a state of depression. In the middle of thinking about the fame that that my works were bringing me, I would say to myself, oh, very well, you'll be more famous than Gogol, Pushkin, Shakespeare, Moliere, more famous than all the writers in the world. Well, so what? I came to the precipice, and I clearly saw there was nothing ahead except ruin, and there was nothing ahead except the deception of life and happiness and the reality of suffering and death and complete annihilation. Okay, he's going through a difficult time, right? But he was able to see, that's great, you're famous. The dark death is coming, and nobody's going to remember your name. So Christians have another part of the story, right? But when you're in the darkness, and this is actually an important thing that we need to bring many of our secular friends, you need to bring them to this point saying, what then once you achieve all these things? What then once you've accumulated that? And we actually need to go to that point, I think, as well. He said, I'm going to be forgotten, even him, right? The logic of this is not only ambition is because once you have that title, you'll be quickly forgotten, but there's another part in my Bible in chapter 4, Ecclesiastes 4:15. He says something very interesting, too, about the problem with ambition of getting your title or whatever. He says this, I saw that all who lived and walked under the sun followed the youth, the king's successor. So they're not following the king. They're thinking, oh, what's next, right? That new guy, he's going to really bring it, right? There was no end to all the people who were before them. All sorts of young people wanted to take the king's role or the CEO job or whatever it might be. But those who came later were not pleased with the successor. That is, when you got that job, it turns out people aren't going to be pleased with you for some of the things that you have or that we all have and that we do wrong as well. Once you have that point, oftentimes there's more challenges and issues in that difficult or in that leadership position than you thought. If it's only ambition, we're going to be frustrated. And the third thing, though, is a self-actualization, you know, self-actualization. I think this is what our culture says. We're looking at, you know, a series about wisdom for work. Culture says, look, don't go after money, you know, don't go after the title or the status. Just do what you love. Love what you do. Follow your dreams. Don't just settle for a job. Has anybody heard that from a college career counselor or a parent or anything like that? Just follow your dreams. But the question I have for you, is that a good idea? Or is that hot air? I mean, that's something that people in wisdom literature, you kind of want to ask that question. There's a guy named Gordon Marino. He wrote this op-ed for the New York Times. He's a college professor at St. Olaf, and he had these students coming into his office all the time, kind of wringing their hands and furrowing their brows, trying to wonder, should I be a doctor, or a philosopher, or a stand-up comic? I just don't know what I should do. And he said, look, there's a lot of choices, and that's fine that you have choices, but that's a privilege, because most of the folks in Northfield, Minnesota, I'm from Minnesota, they either work in the fields, right, or they're in a factory, or they become a roofer. They have far less options here. He says the rub, and a writer that actually Gordon Marino cited, her name is Mia Tokumitsu, she wrote for Slate, she says, do what you love is kind of elitist, because it undermines the work that's not done out of passion. So Steve Jobs was one of these famous guys. He said, do what you love, only do what you love. But what about the thousands and thousands and thousands of people in factories around the world that are producing component parts for the iPhones? Did they do what they loved, or did they work out of duty, necessity to provide for your family? Is that work less valuable than doing what you love? I mean, of course, we would love to do what we love, but the question that I think we have to ask ourselves is, are my dreams, are my personal ambitions number one? Number one. This is the really convicting thing that I was preparing for this sermon. You have to ask yourself, is this do what you love? Is this code for I'm privileged and I want to do is what I please? And if I'm not doing what I please, then darn it, I'm not going to be happy. That's how it is. There is a kind of a peer I have. Her name is Kate Harris. She works at the Washington Institute for Faith, Vocation, and Culture. She goes around the country talking about vocation. Vocation, when you get to studying it, it's really beautiful. Vocation is this idea of living all of your life in response to the call of God, including your work, not just your work, but also your family and everything else. But when she talks to people about the word vocation, oftentimes it's code for my ideal job and what I want to do, something that's kind of forever over the rainbow, or something that's, you know, the grass always greener on the other side, and that's what my vocation is. So she's, you know, people say, I feel called to this and I feel called to that. But the word called should be response to the voice of a caller. Like, is that coming from prayer? Or is that kind of your personal preferences and career preferences? Because the interesting thing about the word vocation or calling in the Bible, very rarely is it do what you love. Very, very rarely. Moses, right? Called bringing people, the Israelites, out of slavery from Egypt and then 40 years of complaining. Did he love that? Jeremiah, he was called to be, was a kid, to be a prophet to the nations. And in Jeremiah 20:14, said, cursed be the day I was born. May the day my mother bore me not be blessed. I mean, he was called, but, you know, didn't exactly love that one. And Paul, of course, was called to be the great Gentile prophet to the Gentiles, the missionary to the Gentiles, right? God literally tells him through Ananias, I will show you how much you must suffer for my name. It's more common in the Christian story to suffer for the good of others, to receive a call and say, this is for the good of others, and to think, I am going to self-actualize. I'm going to find my own path, and then I will finally be happy. What's the commonality between accumulation and ambition, self-actualization, all these A words, right? It's me. It's me. It's my achievement. See, Ecclesiastes, what it does is it takes us down, has to cut us off at the knees and say, you're actually, don't take me wrong here, but you're not actually not as important as you think you are. No, we're all important. God loves you, okay? You guys hear that a lot. We're all important, but we're not actually that important that it's the universe centers around you. A lot of our narratives, cultural narratives about work, they're very self-centered and focused on ourselves. So the question that I have is, what's the doorway out of this? Okay, how do you get out of this view of work that really revolves around self? And that's my second point, is work is gift. Work is gift. Ecclesiastes 3, 12 through 13. I know that there is nothing better for people than to be happy and to do good while they live, that each of them may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all their toil, even when it's difficult. This is the gift of God. The door into God's will for our work is not our talents or opportunities. It's not even first what the world needs. It's gratitude. It's gratitude for a gift. Let me give you an example. Anne Voskamp is the mother of 6 homeschool children. She lives in Canada. She's the wife of a farmer. You know, she's got all sorts of interesting stuff going around at her house on a day-to-day basis. And one day she got a really bad news. She got a dreaded diagnosis from a doctor that she had cancer. She learned that cancer had been eating away at her body as she had birthed these 6 kids. And it became hard for her to get up during the day and to find motivation to work, because am I going to die? What's going to happen to me? She says, I wake to self-hatred. I'm quoting Anne here, to wrestle, to get it all done. The restless anxiety that I'm failing. I always failing. I yell at children. I fester with bitterness. I forget doctor appointments, lose library books, live selfishly, skip prayer, complain. I go only to be late. I neglect cleaning the toilets. I live tired, and I'm afraid. This is where she was. And then she saw one day a book at her hairdresser. It's kind of one of those coffee table books, and it said, 1,000 places that you must see before you die. She thinks, am I going to die? Do I have to go and see 1,000 places? There's something out there that I need to go do and kind of suck up all the life I can before I die? Or her question was, can there be life here, now, in this moment? Or in her words, can the wonder be explained or found in this moment? So she decides to do this activity. She decides to write down 1,000 things that she's grateful for, that she sees as God's gifts to her. As it turns out, when you actually try to do this, 50 to 100, not that hard, but when you get to like 300 or 400, you really got to start noticing the things around you that you're grateful for, especially if you're not going to repeat. And so she starts to notice, right? And so she's in her journal, number 457. She says, thankful for brown eggs, fresh from the hen house, wife of a farmer. 485, hair bows holding back curls. 513, boys jiggling jello. 526, new toothbrushes. 613, paper bag puppet shows. 664, nylons without runs. Don't know about that one. 748, mama delivering chicken soup to the back door. She sees God's gifts everywhere around her in her moment. Given, she's got a ton of stuff. She's homeschooling her kids, and she's got given a lot that seems quite difficult, right? But when she starts to see these gifts around here, her whole life changes, and she starts to focus on this word, this biblical word in the New Testament, Eucharisteo. Eucharisteo, that's where we get the word Eucharist, and all it means is to give thanks. To give thanks. She starts to see this. Actually, there's a word inside of Eucharisteo, a Greek word. The word is charis, and that's the Greek word for grace. She says, when I give thanks for these gifts, everything changes. My disposition, my attitude toward my work changes. One, an Orthodox theologian named Alexander Schmiemann says this, Eucharist, which remember this is Thanksgiving, Eucharist, is the state of the perfect man. Eucharist is the life of paradise. Eucharist is the only full and real response of man to God's creation, redemption, and gift of heaven. The question I want to ask you guys, like, what would change if you saw where you're at right now in your work? Not always what's beyond there, what's my vocation, but right now, if it was a gift, as Ecclesiastes says, if it was a gift to you, the sending the emails, the Qdoba with coworkers, the driving up Santa Fe in traffic, what if this could be a gift? I mean, I can be a skeptical guy, right? So I think all work gift, okay, there's terrible dehumanizing work. I was driving home this morning from the first service, and I see these guys, the 90-degree heat, holding 80% off signs on the street corner. Do you see that? I think that, darn it, that work should not exist. I also think, though, in a very much more difficult context, I mean, what about American slavery, the work that they did? Not exactly a gift. Not exactly a gift. But let's not underestimate the power of gratitude. We actually asked that question. We had a chance to interview a guy named Eugene Peterson, who wrote this book called The Message on Work and Vocation. We said, how could slavery be a gift? How could this be a gift from God? And he says, well, you know what they did? They told stories, and they sang the spirituals in the cotton fields. And not all the time, but cries of thank you, Jesus, would oftentimes come out. And this is the subtext, then, that I think is the strength of American spirituality, is the African-American church. A little biased, because I go to an African-American church or a multicultural church. But this is strength. This is why during the Civil Rights Movement, Martin Luther King Jr. Is able to say people that don't have power or privilege or status, but he's able to say this. He says, look, we have to head out to do our jobs so well that nobody could do them better. No matter what the job is, you must decide to do it well. Do it so well that the living, the dead, the unborn can't do it better. If it falls your lot to be a street sweeper, sweep streets like Raphael painted pictures, sweep streets like Michelangelo carved marble, sweep streets like Beethoven composed music, sweep streets like Shakespeare wrote poetry, sweep streets so well that all of heaven and earth will have to pause and say, here lived a great sweeper who swept his job well. He's assuming here that these people do not have the privilege of saying you get to do this or this or this, but it can still be honoring to God because it's done for him. It can be this attitude of gratefulness for what I have and then an opportunity to give and to serve. Work is a gift. Ask the unemployed. Work is a gift. Ask those who have retired and haven't found a way to also find a way to continually give. Oftentimes, that happens in retirement. You see people that they work and they found so much of their identity in work that they kind of fall off the map. the strong people move into retirement and they say, how can I continually give? How can I work? You know, whether it's paid or unpaid, I guess that's not as important. But God has so designed the world that doesn't stop when we become 65, that we work for 6 days and rest for one. How many hours, and all of that changes, but work is a gift, and it continually being a gift because it's our opportunity to give. 1 Peter 4:10 says this, each of you should use whatever gifts you have received to serve others. Use the gifts, God's good gifts to you, to serve others. And then he repeats the word gift, but Peter says this, as faithful stewards of God's grace in its various forms, as God's gift. That's the same biblical word. Look, when we get to this point, you need to take Ecclesiastes, you take a grain of salt, but you got to have the cold water dumped on your head first to bring ourselves down, to receive the good gift first of what work is and what work can be. Because when we first are saying, God, I'm grateful. I'm grateful for what you've given to me here in the now, in this present moment. It opens the door to work as service, and that's the final point. Work as service. Ecclesiastes 3:12. I know that there's nothing better for people than to be happy and to do good while they live. Do good, do good. So this isn't kind of individual acts of piety. In the Old Testament, that there's a word for the righteous person, the tzaddik, or the righteous people are the tzaddikim. These are people that are doing public acts of good, that care about the well-being of their community. And that is essentially what drives them and motivates them. Let me give you an example of this. A guy named Bob. He graduated from a Christian university, works a huge accounting firm, right? Pushes numbers every day. An email comes from somebody higher up and asks if anybody wants to be in this committee that decides how their huge accounting firm gives away their charitable dollars. Most people said, no, I mean, that's boring. They're not even going to give us time off for it. I mean, they started to complain, right? Not him. He says, well, hey, that's kind of cool. I'm going to sign up for that. So he goes to this committee meeting, and the first committee meeting, he gets himself elected chair. Now, after 2 years, in his context of where he's at, he's able to not only help his company give away more money to communal needs, but he's also able to say, okay, so we're accountants, we have these skills and abilities. How could we use this to serve both our existing clients as well as perhaps those in the community that don't have access to people that can prepare their taxes? He's able to organize for his entire company these service days where they're doing their taxes for the elderly and for low-income families. He said, okay, where am I at right now? Where are the gifts and where are the opportunities where I can serve, right? Okay, so what does this look like? Wisdom for our work. What does this framework of doing good look like? How do we choose? The question is, where is God calling me? Where is God calling me right now? What is the wise path? This is a question that a guy named Richard Baxter, he's a 17th century pastor, he got a lot from his flock. These are common questions. And he gave some real practical advice. I'm going to leave you that with this. He gave a few different things. He says, okay, there's a couple things that work can't, there's a couple things that can't be a calling, okay? Number one, sinful or unlawful work can't be a calling. If you see something that's like literally legal, just don't do that. That's not a calling, okay? Number two, just because a job is legal, it doesn't mean it can be a calling. And this is interesting because there's moral ambiguity here, right? What about gambling? We're in Colorado. What about selling pot? What about in some industries that have so institutionalized consumerism? And consumerism is not like, it's good. I mean, we all need to buy products and services. This is a basic good thing. Consumerism is you just actually want the purchase. You want the thrill of the purchase. What industries have done that? I mean, he says, look, not all types of works can be a calling, but just because there's a market to do something, maybe we shouldn't be doing all these different things. And these are the questions that he actually pushes back in his congregation. I'll give to you as well. You got to think about those things, right? Is this job honorable? Am I doing good? And number three says, don't choose a job that drains your soul or tempts you, right? Or tempts you. So actually, he illustrates this. Interesting. He says, makes this point with beer sellers in his age. He says that their calling is lawful and needful, yet depends on people drinking to excess to make a significant profit. Now, I live in Colorado. I'm under 35, so that means I'm more likely to agree with Benjamin Franklin, who says beer is proof that God loves us and wants us to be happy. So I disagree with Baxter on this point. But nonetheless, you need to think before you get into a field of work, is this a temptation for me? And different fields of work have different temptations, right? Finance, it can be greed, though there's amazing things with finance. We can provide the capital that businesses need. Fashion can be vanity, but of course it could be providing beauty for the world. All these different things you have to say, what does this do to my soul? But then how should I choose a job, right? What does this look like? And he so agrees with Ecclesiastes. He says, number one, this is it. Here's the point. This is what you choose a career. And I'll quote him. He says, the principal thing to be intended in the choice of a trade or calling for yourselves or your children is, number one, the service of God. And after that, the public good. And therefore, other things being equal, that calling which most conduces to the public good is to be preferred. So service and God and public good, what's not in there? It's very interesting. Your Myers-Briggs is not in there. Your personality profile, the opportunity bubbling up on, you know, LinkedIn, that's not necessarily on there. Those are important things, but they all are behind the call of God in your life of serving him and then saying, how much good can we do with what we have in this context right now? You see, when we were on the early part of our talk today, this accumulation, work is accumulation. When money becomes the end of our work, all sorts of stuff gets messed up. But when God becomes the end of our work, everything gets put into a right order. Augustine had this idea. If we love anything more than God himself, our loves become distorted and our lives become distorted. They become idols. But when we love God higher than any other, these loves become ordered behind them and life starts to take on more beauty and meaning. And so he says, you know, for instance, choose a career that won't crush your Sabbath rest. And you can take a Sabbath rest, and that's just fine. It's fine to make a decent salary. Choose a job with a reasonable wage. You're not more noble if you're working for a non-profit than if you're working for a for-profit. Like, we all need for-profits. These are obvious, right? These shoes made by a for-profit, right? These are good things. Work in these. It's accumulation is not the end. But of course, choose a job that provides a decent wage for your family and for those that you're responsible for, which is how a lot of people make simple work decisions every day. And he also says, ask a veteran in the field or company before making a final decision, you know, before you jump into the water. You know, it's good to kind of test the temperature a little bit first. I mean, Baxter's got some really good stuff on this if you want to look it up later, and I won't go into more detail into that. But the point of this, when we start to say, God, what are you calling me to? And we don't mean like my personal preferences, but you actually go and try to hear his voice, right? And you talk to your community. And the service of God, even if it's difficult, right? And even if it doesn't 100% line up with what you thought you would be doing, this can be beautiful for you, for your community, and in relationship with God. Last thing I want to leave you with, there's a guy named Vaclav Havel. He was a Czech playwright. And he ended up becoming a statesman, saw a lot of pain and suffering in his days, but was a very interesting guy. He wrote in this book on civilization kind of a broad view of what when things go really wrong in the world, like what's happening. And he says this. He says, whenever I've encountered any kind of deep problem with civilization anywhere in the world, be it the logging of rainforests, ethnic or religious intolerance, the brutal destruction of a cultural landscape that has taken centuries to develop, somewhere at the end of a long chain of events that gave rise to the problem at issue, I've always found one and the same cause. He says, a lack of accountability to and responsibility for the world. We live in a culture that says not so much responsibility, but we say it's my right. It's my right to do as I please. It's my right to do whatever I want. And oftentimes we have this very atomistic, individualistic view of our work that tends to revolve around self. But he says, what about others? What about your responsibility to care for others, to provide things that our communities need? Responsibility to respond first and foremost to the call of God in our life. As Christians, you're swimming way upstream on this, you know, and this is not easy. Especially if you do something that isn't prestigious, or maybe the parents say, oh, I can't believe you're doing that, right? It can be a challenge. But this is where Qoheleth, the author of Ecclesiastes, and this is where the Bible takes us. This, I think, is wisdom for work. Let's pray. Father, thank you for giving us guidance. It was necessary, I think, for us to take a look first at all the things that we try to do and we make either work an idol, we make money an idol, or our status an idol, or my personal preferences or desires an idol. Lord God, I pray that we would receive what you've given us as a gift of grace, the common gifts that you give us on a daily basis, as well as the gift in your Son. And may we gratefully take those gifts and the skills and talents you've given us to serve others, that all the world might know your name. In your name we pray.